This is the Bristol Cable.
I spent years going to protests and marching and making the placards. And then I realised that we also need people inside the political buildings helping shape policy, helping make change.
I'm Neil Maggs, and this is Bristol Unpacked, speaking to fascinating Bristolians on topics where others may fear to tread. Brought to you by the city's community-owned media, the Bristol Cable. In this episode of Bristol Unpacked, it's election specials again. This time it's Emma Edwards. She's the nominated group leader for the Bristol Greens, and she's the councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down. Enjoy. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Neil. How you doing?
I'm doing well. And where am I talking to you from?
I'm at home in St Andrews.
You're the only leader, local leader, that's been interviewed by me before.
I'm honoured.
Yeah. How was it last time?
It was good. I actually re-listened to it last week just to sort of remind myself. And yeah, it feels like quite a long time ago. It feels like lots has happened since then, but it's also been no time at all. It's one of those kind of weird time jumps.
How long ago was it?
So I was elected as Green Group Leader in February of last year, so February 23.
And you still are?
Yes, yes.
Although, as we speak, there has been a press release to announce who will be your leader of the council.
That's right, yes.
Who is it?
So it's Councillor Tony Dyer from Southville Ward.
Ah, okay.
Yes, and with Heather Mack, who was group leader before me, as our nomination for deputy.
Return of the Mack.
Return of the Mack, indeed, yes.
Okay. And so that's three leaders then?
Yeah, so we had, this was a sort of a discussion in many councils that the leader of the largest group is also the council leader. We possibly could have done it that way. I think that would still be allowed as long as they only took sort of one allowance. But we think, well, I think they're very different roles. So when we had that discussion, and I think it was discussed in the committee model working group, we looked at it in the constitution as well as party group leaders to separate those roles out or have the option to separate those roles out, which, again, it's quite a Green Party thing to do, to put more layers of democracy.
Yeah, I mean, you haven't even got, you're the only one that's got two national leaders, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. So any opportunity to do politics a bit different, we're always very interested in.
So the slight difference, sorry to jump in, Emma, the slight difference with what you're doing and say what Tony will be doing is yours is more of an inward facing party role and his is more representing the Green Party and potentially the council at Wecker events, talk to the media, go into, I don't know, local authority events, things like that, yeah?
Yeah, and representing the interests as of the council as a whole. So although we'll be a Green and have Green priorities, we'll still be overseeing the council under the new committee system. So, you know,
that's only if he's voted in, though, isn't it?
That's only if he's voted in, yes.
Yeah. And that will probably be, I'm assuming people will probably vote with their parties, won't they, on that? So therefore, if you increase your majority, then that's probably a bit
I mean, there's still numbers to play with, definitely. You would expect the largest group to put forward a council leader and that be...
Okay.
That,
you know. We are here to talk to you and to talk about you. But I do think to mention Tony that he probably, it's probably quite a shrewd decision in some ways because he probably would be seen as the Labour Party's favourite Green. do you not think so, a little bit?
If they have a favourite Green, possibly. I think Tony is well-liked.
There's a low bar for them, I think, on that, to be fair. But yeah.
I think Tony has the skills of being liked and is able to get on with councillors in all parties. And I think
the
work
kind of
he's
I mean.
Done in scrutiny as the chair of the scrutiny board, the Oversight Management Scrutiny Board, OSM, has allowed him to form those relationships with other councillors. And so, he is well-liked and well-
And within that role, he will need to be collegiate and work cross-party and stuff like that. So he needs to be somebody that sort of builds alliances, Whereas you can continue in your role- as leader of the Greens, and you just be horrible to all of them. It doesn't matter.
Well, I mean,
you can use your Twitter account in exactly the same way that you currently do.
I think I'm not on Twitter as much as I used to be. I don't have time to be on Twitter as much as I used to be. But yeah, my role as Green Group Leader is to represent the interests of the group and the Green councillors, which I do already, and have those meetings with party group leaders. But it will be very much working with Tony.
As would you have a strategy, therefore, that if somebody wanted to be a bit meaner and fire a shot across the bowels at any of the opposition parties, it would be better for you to do it than Tony, because in his position, would you have some sort of, like, I don't know, strategic agreement?
I suppose technically that is the role of the group leader. I think I'm not a particularly strong arrow thrower. I tend to, I think you catch more flies.
Oh, I don't know. All right, you might not be throwing sort of, bazookas, but I think you're subtly... What are the little frog darts? Yeah, tranquilizer darts quietly from a tree from the sidelines. No? Yeah,
you call out things when they need calling out.
Yeah,
for sure. But okay. I don't see the point of attacking for attacking's sake.
No. So we are where we are now. We're coming into the 2nd of May. You've just launched your manifesto, and we'll go into that shortly. Before that, though, obviously another big change is going to be the end of the mayoral system, moving into the committee system.
Yes.
What was the last full council meeting like, all the sort of the last speech from the mayor and people giving eulogies and stuff? What was that like?
Yeah, no, I think it went out quite quietly, really. There was no fanfare. I don't know if we were expecting a fanfare. I think Tory councillor Richard Eddy stood up at the last minute and said a few words about councillors that were leaving, which I think was probably right to thank the long-standing councillors who were stepping down.
And quite a few of them, aren't there? Well, particularly in the Labour Party. What about, obviously, you were... Pivotal was certainly felt quite strongly about removing the mayoral model when we spoke last time.
Yeah.
And obviously you've got what you've kind of wanted now. Has it been quite tough the last sort of year, kind of knowing it's going to change? Probably some degree of annoyance, anger, slight resentment by some of the mayoral team and some of the dynamics, is it being a bit loaded?
I've definitely noticed that. I think the Green Group has noticed that kind of outgoing mayor, maybe his attitude has changed in some ways, and it felt towards the end that there was a sense of frustration. We've also been keeping an eye out for those things that were going to happen before he went and making sure that we weren't left with any nasty surprises.
Was it a bit like when Trump's on the way out and he was pardoning everybody and handing out to his mates? And did you have to keep an eye on that? It was almost like a scorched earth policy. Was that what you were sort of
careful of? We've certainly
been
keeping an eye on things. Yeah. I think, again, that's possibly more something that Tony's been doing as part of the scrutiny, because a lot of this is looking at things coming through scrutiny. I feel my role has been a bit more of a positive role. It's been preparing the group for the change to the committee system. Yeah. So
you've got what you wanted, haven't you? Yeah, you've got what you wanted. It's changed.
Absolutely.
There's no point in, you've got to look forward.
Look to the future. And I think that's probably been my kind of main focus of the last year. I mean, obviously, there's been a lot going on within the councillor group. There's been a lot going on in the council. There's been lots of things to deal with that have come up. Yeah. But my side work and the work I do behind the scenes has been reaching out to other councillors who are in committee systems, finding out what has worked, what hasn't worked, how to make that transition as smooth as possible, working with the committee model working group, working with the council officers to, like, how are we going to make this transition?
And for those that don't know, that listen, you have had a sort of subcommittee that's been set up to oversee the transition a bit, haven't you?
So there was the committee model working group, affectionately known as the committee, that kind of looked at how it would work, which was a cross-party.
Were you on that yourself?
No, I wasn't, no. Okay. But
was it true? And I don't know, and I don't want to stake this up too much, but the charge was that some people that obviously around the mayor, certain people in the Labour Party that were annoyed that the referendum went the way it did, were slightly obstructive with that process, or if not obstructive, certainly weren't being as supportive of that committee as they could have been?
I think we talked about this last time. There wasn't a lot of provisions left for the setting up of the committee system. Yeah. So I think that has fallen to a handful of officers and party group leaders as well. So it's been through the committee model working group, which I think was pretty successful. Again, it's the first time, it's not the first time, but it's that example of what cross-party working is going to look like.
Yeah.
So I think that went pretty well. And then working with party group leaders to look at how that transition's going, working with officers. And there's still going to be people who are either cynical or nervous about the committee system. It's a change of governance system. So I think looking at the potential pitfalls and how you would deal with them, how it's going to be structured, how we're going to deal with it fairly, I think that's been a focus for me. And that's what I'm really interested in as well. Because, you know, you hear people saying, oh, we're going back to the old committee system, like it's a return to something that's really archaic. Mm-hmm. And we don't want people to see it that way. We see this as an opportunity for more democracy, more transparency, more resident engagement, more cross-party working, certainly tackling some of the kind of toxic party politics within City Hall. So we've got loads of opportunities.
Do you think people want it to fail, though? Some people do want it to fail.
I don't know if people want it to fail, but I have noticed some Labour candidates acting like it's the end of the world. Go, oh, no, we're going into a committee. And I'm like, well, if you're standing in this election, you're going into a committee system. Mm. We're really excited about it. Obviously, we know it's going to be new and it's going to be hard work and there might be some teething troubles, but we've been preparing for that and we've been working towards that. I don't understand why you would go into a committee system if you were going into it with dread. Sure. You know, a bit of healthy trepidation, I think, is fine, but I think this is a real opportunity. And we did have a referendum. People did say they wanted this. And,
It's a late turnout, but, you know, the public voted for it, didn't they? For you as the party leader, arguably, you're in a more difficult position than any of the other parties because you don't whip your councillors. So as you potentially get more councillors and have more of a prominent role in the committee system moving forward, managing that party discipline, how is that a challenge that you're going to tackle?
I think there's this idea about us not being whipped, like it's just chaos and it's just every person for themselves. And that is just not the case. We come to consensus through debate, we discuss, we come up with steers. It's not the same as whipping because the difference is there's no discipline for not agreeing to that particular steer. However, we still make a conscious effort to come up with a steer that works for as many people as possible. However, if somebody says, look, this isn't good for whatever reason, I don't want to vote this way because I have a valid choice, and they explain that to us, there's not going to be any discipline. We still have a whip. We still have those steers based on our own party policy. We are a political party with a manifesto and policies, which is a pretty good guideline. But we also have discussions based on the work we're doing with people in Bristol, the work we're doing in our wards. I think it actually makes really healthy politics and it prepares you for going into a committee system because a lot of that is sitting down and having good discussions with people who you might have a disagreement with. So, you know, I think they just think we all just turn up on full council and just vote whichever way we feel that day. And that's not what being whipped means. It just means that we come to those political steers in a slightly different way.
I mean, you are and have been gathering momentum.
Yeah.
How many seats have you got now?
24.
So it's a 2-seat majority. Mm-hmm. Right, thinking
one now. There's been a few changes, but so...
And presumably you're hoping to increase that. Do you have a number?
Not a number in particular, but I think we're going to pick up a few more seats. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm pretty certain we're going to pick up a few more seats as well.
And have you reflected on why there's been this surge in Bristol?
I think...
How much is it to do with what you have done or perhaps also what other parties do and where's the middle ground?
That's a really good question. I think it's probably both. It's probably several factors. If you look at the rest of the country, in local politics, we have had a surge of how many councillors we have. We're in administration in quite a few councils around the country now. We're getting bigger and bigger green groups forming in various places. So that suggests to me that people like the Green Party, not just in Bristol, but with speaking to people on a more general level, that I think is to do with our environmental policies. People are becoming more and more aware of climate change and worried about inaction on climate change. Younger people, I think, like our policies. But at the same time, I think there is also a lot of people who are disillusioned with the two main parties and the two-party system. Mm. And where maybe they feel they can't get that change in Parliament yet, because of first past the post, this is somehow way they can get green representation. And then what they're doing is they're getting green representation and they're liking it and they're seeing that that works and that's sort of allowing that movement to grow. That being said, I think it also comes down to our councillors. We've got some fantastic councillors, candidates who, the way we select councillors or the way councillors come to us, they tend to be people who are very rooted in their communities.
I know you've changed that, haven't you? I want to ask you specifically about that, actually, about the profile of the type of councillors and the type of people that are coming to the Green Party now, that are standing. Previously, people perhaps being primarily wedded to environmental issues. To some people that probably would be naturally more aligned with the sort of left of Labour a bit, that you've got standing. So I just wonder how much, with the sort of shift a little bit in the Labour Party from Corbyn to Starmer, whether there are sort of lapsed Corbynites coming in the direction of the Greens.
Yeah, I wouldn't just say lapsed Corbynites. I think we've seen quite a few people coming over from Labour to the Greens. Not as many necessarily councillors in Bristol, but I think that nationally has happened. Certainly with our supporters, that has happened a lot. I've been out on the doorsteps. And I think, Sunday in particular, I think I had five chats with people who were just leaving Labour. And they didn't say, I love the Greens. They're like, I'm disillusioned with Labour. I'm really interested in the Greens. Can you tell me more about it? They already know that we're an environmental party because that's what we're known for. So they want to know what our social justice policies are.
And things like the stance on Palestine internationally that has been very different than the Labour Party. And I think that's been quite, particularly in a city like Bristol, that's been where there's a lot of activists and people with a bit more.
That's definitely been a factor we found. Yeah. And I'm certainly very pleased with our stance, but how that has spoken to some people, I think that has been a red line for some people as well. So we're getting supporters from all over now. And, you know, this, I'm talking about Bristol and that being a city that has been traditionally quite left-wing. You can go out to other places, more rural places, and we're picking up seats from people who might have traditionally voted Conservative because they like our environmental policy in their area. Oh, you know, you're protecting green spaces, you're protecting the say green and pleasant land, you know what I mean?
And I've noticed it actually, and I don't know if you have or people listening have, is that there's definitely also been a bit more of a media presence nationally from the Green Party in the last couple of years. I think certainly in the last year, you know, on big programs, still not as much as the big parties, granted.
But nearly as much coverage.
I wouldn't suggest you did, but there's definitely been a more of a focus. And I wonder, and it's something when I spoke to Mark Weston about this, that he was very much trying to push back against conversations too much around the national picture for the Tories and about this is all about local issues, local. And I'm like, well, you would say that because you would want to, you know, strategically, if I was advising you, I would suggest you did that and you steered it away. Whilst people do care about local issues and this is a local election, the national picture does have an impact, doesn't it? It has an impact upon which way people vote, I think.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. And also they are all linked. I mean, obviously people think about local issues because they're happening, but I think people are realising now that is part of the bigger picture. The way we get funding, a lot of that still comes from the government. And so that austerity, those cuts, that comes all the way down to local government. Sure.
You can't divorce the two entirely, can you? The profile, though, I do think the profile, and I think where the profile of Bristol, and this is obviously a target seat for you in the general election when that comes in October, November, having the leader of the Green Party or the co-leader of the Green Party in Bristol, has that had a ripple effect a little bit in terms of people coming your way?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, I certainly think in central Bristol it is. I think we've all been amazed at how Carla's campaign has taken off and how much attention it's drawn. And I think if you'd have asked me 2 years ago if Carla was going to get elected, I would have had to have given a politician's answer of, I hope so and I think so. Where now I'm like, well, you know, polls are reflecting that and we are seeing it and we are hearing it from people. And it's like,
which is crazy, really, because the Thangam Debonair had one of the biggest majorities in that general election.
Yeah, and I think that has to be a reflection of the national picture as well. That has to be a reflection on how people are feeling about Labour, especially, as you say, people who are a little bit more left-wing Labour.
Yeah.
Again, over
mainly posh middle-class people from London, though, Emma?
middle class people from London, what?
Yeah, they're voting. Obviously, the boundaries have changed a bit, haven't they, in terms of the MP seats. I suppose I'm kind of parroting Labour's line a bit, slightly tongue-in-cheek.
Obviously.
This is just demographic change, posh middle class people. Coming in.
It's not our experience. Our experience is, it's a bit like, that's what people used to say about Green councillors, that it was all one type of person. And you can see by the diversity of our candidates that we've got a diversity of backgrounds, class, experience, race, heritage. It's
harder for Labour and the other parties to play the man or the woman, not the bull. Because there's been a little bit of that, hasn't there? That kind of every time a particular issue or a policy is raised, it then becomes like, well, what do you know? You don't know. You know, it becomes. Yeah. Is that happening less now? Because I know that was something that was quite regular.
I would like to say it is. I think we going back to what you were saying earlier about what it's been like as the mayor's moving out, I think we've still seen some quite difficult politics and slightly toxic situations still happening in City Hall. However, that is something I think we really want to get rid of. And I think more importantly, people in Bristol want to get rid of. I've never chatted to anyone in Bristol who's like, you know, it's so great. You know, yeah. I love how you're always in these stressful situations with one another. I think it's really put people off Labour as well over certain things, certain decisions that had been made and their responses to us, I think has put people off. I'm really hoping that what I said before about a slight sort of self-selection of who is going to be standing in this election, knowing they're going into a committee system. It's like, we are going to have to get on better. We are going to have to work together. We're going to have to appreciate that there is not just a diversity of people, but there's a diversity of ideas. That being said, some points of our manifesto are not a million miles away from one another. So we're going to have to work together because that's what people in Bristol want. And that's what we should be doing. I'm really passionate about this. You can probably hear that. Yeah. And maybe that was a little bit of naivety on my behalf going into politics, thinking, oh, it'll be different for us, but it hasn't been. But I think we all want it to be.
On the same issue of candidates for councillors, and it was something that was raised in a couple of the other interviews I've done with the leaders of other parties, was how, as I said earlier, you have changed the profile of who you are recruiting or who's joining. And there does seem to be a kind of mopping up a little bit of a kind of anti-mayor, anti-Marvin sort of alliance a bit. Some of the new candidates, people that are sort of thorns in the side of them a bit, campaigners. Danny Aker, if I said the pronounce that right?
Danica.
Yeah. Being one, a Green campaigner. Shaban, I know he's been suspended and isn't standing there.
He stepped down.
In the past, I suppose you've had Christine as well, that's come from education campaigning, anti-merchant ventures, Catherine Colson, stuff like that. It's more of a community activist, sort of radical energy, sort of candidate rather than a sort of traditional Green Party candidate. Yeah. And I'm not necessarily saying that's a good or a bad thing. I just didn't know if that was almost like a deliberate recruitment strategy a little bit.
I don't think it's a deliberate recruitment. I think it's more that people who are passionate activists are drawn to the Green Party. I'm sure Heather Mack wouldn't mind me telling you that she's been arrested for protesting with XR before. She's also fantastic at finance. She's worked in NGOs. She's worked in sustainability. Just because somebody is an activist and a community activist doesn't mean they haven't also got other skills or other professional backgrounds. Danica has worked in biodiversity. She's worked for environmental companies. She's actually very intelligent and she's got a lot of professional experience as well as being a passionate campaigner. Same as Christine. Christine's worked in education. I've got a bit of an activist background. So I think you can be a very passionate person. You can be an activist. You get activists from all walks of life. That was something I think we noticed with the XR movement. You were getting elderly vicars gluing themselves to roads. You know, it's like when you feel passionate and you're an activist, great. If you then realize through activism that you can make a difference in a different way by going into politics, that was my journey. I spent years going to protests and marching and making the placards and doing all of that. And then I realized that we also need people inside the political buildings helping shape policy, helping make decisions and helping make change, which you can't you're slightly limited by being outside just waving the placards. We still need the people outside waving the placards. And that is all a lot of people have as well. With the youth climate strikes, you see that's often people's first spark of interest in politics. My first big protest, I think, was against the Iraq War, the one in 2003. You know, mm-hmm. and you do, you say, oh, okay, there's this feeling, and you get it, and you get that people power, and it's very exciting. And that is enough for some people. But then if you also have a knowledge or a professional experience, that then also allows you to then become a good politician.
So it can just be, and this is true, ironically, for some people in the Labour Party, they've been quite critical of protests, actually, that we're not a party of protests, we're a party of government and all this kind of stuff. You know, but it's actually even true of, and there's an awful lot of people who were community activists that came into that space 8, 9, 10 years ago. So that actually, that can just be a stepping stone, can't it? I suppose it's a different skill set, isn't it? And it's a different, you will be in a different position where you have some degree of responsibility and you have to make decisions and all that kind of stuff. But also with the, you might also have to create some daylight between some protest group and yourselves. And there is a sort of charge levied at you a bit. And Labour Party have been down this route themselves. So that might be why they're saying it, I don't know. But Tom Renard did suggest that, what did he say? I can't remember the precise quote when I interviewed him, but he said something along the lines of, it's very hard to distinguish between the Green Party and Acorn at the moment. And obviously we've seen some slightly unsavoury scenes at City Hall with Acorn, the union, protesting over things to do with Barton House and holding the Merrill team and stuff to account. The sort of charge is that you're sort of a little bit in bed, a bit in cahoots with Acorn. And could that get a bit sticky as and when you get more power?
I mean, that's only one interpretation of our relationship. I just think we've got a good relationship with Acorn because we sit down and talk to them. We do have some Green councillors and candidates who are Acorn members.
Yeah.
Acorn are a renters union. You know, didn't the Labour Party start in the union movement as well? I thought that was something that Labour used to be very keen on. So that seems a bit weird that Labour are going, oh my goodness, they've got a good relationship with unions. It does seem a bit strange.
I think you're right. And actually, the Labour Party themselves in Bristol, when Marvin Rees came into power, Paul Smith was housing officer, you know, they said they had Acorn around the table talking to them. And then for whatever reason, there was a kind of split. And if and when things become quite tricky and difficult and you maybe have to say no or you have to push back at certain things, is that going to find you the same sort of level of protest to the mayor following up at the Holiday Inn?
I mean,
you know, barraging in City Hall, shouting stuff. You might be on the end of that. And how are you going to react to it?
We might. I think what we picked up on from why that got particularly toxic was that came out of an incredibly traumatic situation. That protest came out because of what had happened at Barton House was extremely traumatic and was a really difficult situation. And I'm not fully criticizing the way that council handled it. I think things could have been done a lot better. However, it was a very difficult situation.
Yeah,
I don't think necessarily the people involved got that right. And the problem is
people involved with Acorn.
I'm talking about the way that the council maybe didn't take into account just what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying, I don't want to get an argument between Acorn and the council, because I think what you need to think about is the actual people of Barton House.
Yeah,
I was there that night. I was there till 1 a.m. and the amount of trauma that caused. Now, Acorn are a renters union. Their sort of modus operandi is standing up for renters. And if they didn't feel heard and they didn't feel listened to, or that they could represent people they wanted to represent right, I can see why that would then escalate a situation.
Yeah.
That being said, I'm not condoning going into City Hall.
And that is one example of other, have been other situations where that relationship's been tense as well.
I'm not saying what we should do is storm City Hall and have riots. I'm saying there could have been several steps that could have been taken before then.
But that's what they do though, Emma. That, you know, I've interviewed Nick. I know they come from a long time ago. That's what they do. They're a direct action group. That is what they do. So there's a consistency there. You just said, you know, the council, you will be the council pretty soon. And when it's sticking it to the man, so to speak, that's kind of what you guys will be. And it just changes that relationship, doesn't it?
I'm sure it does. But I would say we we would still like to have a conversation. You know, that night at full council, what we were hearing from the people who were shouting from the gallery was like, we feel like we've been denied a conversation.
Yeah. Is that more the personalities of the two leaders, though? That there's a personal beef there, isn't there? But Nick Ballard and Marvin Rees don't get on. I think there's a bit of that going on. Yeah. And sometimes a criticism that I've heard on this show a lot is that when the politics becomes personal, that then intercedes a little bit. But it's just going to be interesting. It's an interesting transition, I think.
It is. And I think that, you know, you've said it, a lot of people from the Green Party have activist backgrounds. Maybe there will be a little, that means there'll be a different approach with other activist groups.
Yeah.
Yes, we've certainly been able to do that more because we are in, we have been in opposition, and there might be an attitude shift towards us when we're more in power.
Yes.
I think we were prepared for that anyway.
The last thing, just on candidates, you've also recruited, there's a few candidates that were former Lib Dems, Labour, other parties coming to you. There's one candidate, I think he's been with every single party in the city except Conservatives now. Is that a bit fair-weathered? I do buy my chicken from him though, so I can't say too much. £5 for a decent bag of skinless chicken.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the first thing that you're concerned about when a candidate wants to join the Green Party. Firstly, we don't recruit. I've heard the word recruit a couple of times. People are selected, and we have they are voted in to be candidates by the.
You don't headhunt people then?
No, we don't headhunt people. I mean, we might find somebody. We might encourage people.
Come on, I don't.
We might encourage people.
You've seen people. Yeah, exactly. You've seen
people. We might encourage
people
that we found and go like, you'll be, especially if they're from a group that are maybe not. You know, we definitely would love to see more women, more people with baby people.
Yeah, and obviously if you're accused of being, as I said earlier, white, posh and middle class, there's people from working class backgrounds, you say there's different people from minority communities. I suppose it's just whether, if you've been to too many political parties, whether you sort of question someone's motivation and conviction to the cause.
I think it's best to judge people on what they want to do. And as you say, it comes back to the fact that we're a growing party. So as we grow, we're appealing to different groups.
Yeah.
I think...
I will get him on. I'll say it. It's Abdul Malik. I'm not going to hide behind. It's Abdul Malik. I know him. I've known him for years. I'll get him on the show and we'll have a chat. We'll have a chat about it.
I think from my chats with him, I think he's great. And I think he'll be fantastic representing Ashley. As I say, to grow as a party, we are going to pick up supporters and maybe candidates.
Where would you draw the line? Where would you not, who would you not have join you? If Richard Eddy suddenly wanted to go, would you have him or not?
I wouldn't want to say you've just found the line, but
I have, maybe. Unwittingly. Okay. Let's get on to your manifesto, Hope and Action.
Hope and Action,
You've stolen that from Marvin. Marvin says Hope. You've nicked it. City of Hope.
I thought his was getting stuff done.
That's the hashtag. Isn't there a Hope thing, isn't it? Are you going to have a hashtag? What's your hashtag going to be?
Oh, that's a good action. That's a good start.
Yeah, comms expert coming in. My day rate, you might not be able to afford, but so Hope and Action.
Hope and Action.
Yeah. Some key sort of focus points: transport and, I guess, growth in the city. And that's something you've been criticised a little bit for, opposing budgets and stuff like that, and trying to grow the city. But I know that's something that you've spoken about being critical and quite key. Let's break that down. Bit by bit, let's talk initially just about transport, ideas for transport.
Yeah.
It's pretty much on record that you've been opposed to the idea of a Bristol Underground and more focused on active travel and buses and trams and stuff. So what's the strategy? What's the vision for this?
So I think with transport, this is, you're saying hope and action. I think this is action, isn't it? Is people are really fed up. People are really fed up. Nothing.
Yeah, we don't want any more hope on this.
We've been bored my bloody life for that.
Yeah.
We need some action now. So I think we've got to do the things that we can do fastest. That's not building an underground. So focusing on improving the bus network, cycling, walking, and finding ways to fund this. So looking at workplace parking levy, that's something I'm really keen on. Also safety as well. So Vision Zero, which was a motion that we got passed last year, which I think is an absolutely fantastic idea. It's happened in other cities around Europe, which would really prioritise people walking around the city, making travel a lot safer. We're not against mass transit either. It's just the idea of having to spend billions and pounds and years building an underground when really we could have dedicated bus lanes and electrify the buses, and then that could maybe be turned into a tram route. Like, let's do it in a sort of a simpler, more logical way.
I was in Manchester a few weeks ago working on something, and they seem to be the sort of barometer of effective and efficient transport systems from anything. That the Beehive thing, how it's connected, they've obviously brought buses into public control. Is that something you want to do?
Absolutely. So the difference between Bristol and Manchester is that they have a transport board. So that would be up to WECA to set up a transport board. We would support that fully, especially if that meant we could look into franchising and then more into public ownership.
Labour have suddenly decided to do that as well, haven't they?
I think it was actually the Lib Dem. I think the Lib Dems actually brought it as a motion, and we both supported it.
It's one of their pledges in their manifesto.
Yeah.
I was a bit like, why are you doing? Why now? Why not?
One of those things where it's like we could probably work together on this because we actually have a similar idea about buses. Mm. There are people in Bristol who are not served by bus routes, and that has to be a priority. We have to allow everybody to have access to a decent bus service. It feels like a no-brainer to say that. It feels that we have a city like Bristol, and that is one of the number one things we hear is that we still have not sorted out our buses. Before we look at any mass transit system, we have to do that. Buses can be like a mass transit system. You know, I'm very lucky. I live just off the Gloucester Road where we have very frequent buses. The rest of the transport isn't necessarily very good. Cycling, you take your life into your own hands.
Mark Weston told me that they're tackling a war on motorists.
Oh, poor motorists. No.
Yeah.
I have heard this. The thing is,
are you ready for war?
Oh, well, Greens, we love war, don't we? I don't think motorists are happy either. Obviously, we haven't got a manifesto that prioritises private car use over anything else. Quite the opposite. However, I don't think car drivers are particularly happy either at the moment, because I used an e-scooter today to get into City Hall, and the traffic was just gridlocked the whole way. I was kind of having to sort of weave between the little gaps in the cars, and I couldn't believe how. And I was just like, I would. You know, driving across Bristol, utterly miserable. By improving buses, by improving active travel, safer, by getting the cyclists into proper cycle lanes, people who need a car, who can't give up their car, you know, disabled community, older community, people who've got kids.
Or just people who live on the periphery of Bristol, you know, in Braintree or Hartlepool, that just struggle, don't they?
Freeing up the roads for them more as well. That being said, we are trying to encourage people to use greener transport methods. And again, I think people want to.
but the people are only going to do that if public transport's better, though, aren't they? Yeah. That's always been the challenge.
The nature of people is that they do the easiest thing. And we cannot criticise people for that, because I do the easiest thing, you do the easiest thing, we all do the easiest thing. That's how you make your decisions moment by moment. And if the easiest thing is to take the bus, you take the bus. Yeah. If the easiest thing is to cycle, you cycle. Mm-hmm. And if the easiest thing to drive, you drive. We need to make the easiest option the greenest option.
If local journalism is going to survive, we need enough money to keep the lights on. The Bristol Cable has not only managed to survive, but to produce quality journalism which, for almost 10 years, has changed lives across our city. We're looking ahead, hopefully, to another 10 years. To do this, we need members to help us unlock a bonus grant. We're now 55% of the way to £60,000. Head to thebristolcable.org/join to become a member or up your contribution.
Housing is, contentious and a big issue in the city. You've pledged to build 1,000 homes a year. How are you going to achieve that?
So there's already a target to build 1,000 homes a year. So it's just finding that way to do it. So there's 14,000 unbuilt homes in Bristol at the moment that have had planning permission. So they need to be built. We also have had our recent motion to bring empty properties into use and turn those into homes. We are aware that there is a housing crisis and that we need homes. but they've got to be the right homes, and they've got to be warm homes and energy efficient homes and affordable homes. And this isn't just about building houses, it's homes for people. So that's also looking at renting, really pushing for rent controls, more landlord licensing.
Is that different than what Labour are doing though? They're proposing the same thing, aren't they?
Again, I think there is some crossover. I mean, we both on the Bristol Living Rent Commission, that was something that both Labour and the Greens supported working with them.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is some work there. I think the idea to bring empty buildings back into use, that was very much a Green idea. I hope Labour support that idea.
Council houses?
Yeah. And also having a social landlord company as well. So that's in our manifesto as well. So that would allow people to have more secure tenancies that are affordable and would work with the arm's length housing company, Gorham Homes. So it would be...
which is, again, more collaborative stuff. I find this interesting. Yeah. And I think you're continuing with City Leap, aren't you? That these are all... And be honest about this. Has there been a conscious effort to slightly pivot from opposing or be seen to be opposing what Labour are doing now that you're moving into this period where you need to be more collegiate, to be more bombastic about the things that you have that are similar? I think you tweeted about it as well, didn't you? About actually, there's not as much difference between us as what people think or something like that.
I mean, a lot of these is like common sense ideas that reflect the national picture anyway. It's like we're in a housing crisis. So obviously Labour want to tackle that. And so do we, because that's a problem that needs solving. I don't think it's a conscious effort. I think it's when you take away some of the drama within City Hall, at the end of the day, we're all ward councillors. So we all speak to residents and we all know what the issues
are. But if you've spent 18 months or a couple of years, if Spain, or, you know, we're different, we're going to do things differently, we do this, we do that, and then suddenly just announce policies which are exactly the same. What's the difference then? What's the point?
The difference comes, I think, with how we do politics. And so this goes back to the governance models. But also one of our kind of key messages at the moment is a slightly more back to basics approach. We've seen a previous Labour administration who were very keen on growth and the projects, the big shiny projects, I mean, I was going to mention the arena. It's not really happening and things, but people do see money being wasted and bailing out certain businesses and wanting to build an underground. You know, it's like, no, that's that. The ambition of that sounds amazing, but when you look at it, there's so much more that we can do quicker and easier that will help people now and not in 30 years' time, which is probably how long that would take.
So you'll be focused more on the less big gesture, big development projects, more sorting, specific kind of things that affect people in a community grassroots sense,
And I think I've said this before, I don't know if it was to you, but you know, when you're on the doorsteps and you're talking to people in your communities and they're like, I'm trying to get my child into a place in the Send school, or I'm trying to get them across the city to do that, or I'm struggling with a landlord and I've got damp. You're listening to that. I've never heard anybody on a doorstep saying, I think Bristol needs to be on the global stage more.
I know. It's interesting. And I know exactly what you mean. If you talk to most people, they don't really give a shit about things like that. However, there has always been big ideas, visionaries. I just made a documentary about Brunel. We spoke about similar stuff, actually, in relation to today about HS2. And actually, do people really want that? Or do they just want better connectivity in the north for better connectivity in the Midlands between local trains and stuff? And yes, they do. But however, those big grand vision projects are why Japan's got bullet trains or why Brunel built the Great Western Railway. Sometimes you do need to push beyond popularity sometimes and be unpopular in public opinion to shift and make big change. And somebody said to me in that documentary, this isn't really about a railway. This is about what that brings. It brings opportunity, it brings jobs, it brings expansion, it brings development, it brings growth, blah, 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 blah. So you need to do a bit of that, Emma, as well, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we are doing that. Look at something like green energy. That is technology that is constantly evolving and changing and is being really innovative. The way we heat our homes and the way we insulate our homes, different energy technologies, they are all innovations and they're there to solve problems, which is it was very much a Brunel thing. Brunel didn't just do things because he could or because they were the biggest, flashiest ideas. I could geek out about this because I love my history. But, you know, if you look at some of the designs for the Clifton Suspension Bridge, the one that was chosen or the one that happened in the end was not the biggest or the flashiest one. You know, it was the one that made the most sense. So
it's about how it affects people's lives and the impact that actually has, rather than it being, are you sort of alluding it to a bit of a vanity project, some of these things then?
Yeah, I mean, that's a term that's been thrown around a lot. And I think that is often how I think those things are seen. There might have been a point in time where that was very attractive. I think because we've been in a cost of living crisis, because we've been in austerity, because people are living in poverty, because there's so many inequalities in the city,
it's become
everyone's feeling a little bit like, I just want to be able to, you know, feed
you think,
my kids.
I don't want to labour this too much. Do you think they've missed, do you think that when those messages come out, and this is, it is relevant to what we're talking about, but going abroad a lot or going to getting big investment, high buildings, all that sort of stuff, that, as you say, a lot of like ordinary people are like, well, I didn't really care about that. Do you think the sort of Labour Party have sort of lost the direction of travel? They're a little bit out of tune with what's going on. And maybe you guys have tuned into that a bit more effectively.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually genuinely do. And that is evidential of, as I say, you know, I keep coming back to our conversations with people, but that's what we do. The advantage of being a small party and being quite grassroots is we are really involved with our residents and our communities. Mm-hmm. And as I say, you don't hear a desire for these kind of big ideas. I'm not saying those big ideas are always awful. Mm-hmm. I think if things that, as you say, bring jobs, improve the economy of a city, is fine. It's the growth for growth's sake. I think we're not as behind.
I wonder if that's a power thing, though. I wonder if that's being in a position of power, holding a budget, being in control of making decisions. And I know obviously that will change, not having the mayoral model, but people will still have to make decisions collectively, is whether that just sort of happens anyway. As in people lose touch a bit and it becomes more about, oh, we want to make a grand gesture. We want to create daylight between us and the previous regime and show that we're getting stuff done now.
I get it, because I think one of
And that's okay. Sorry to jump in. You know, you wouldn't have the Eiffel Tower, would you, if you didn't? You wouldn't have the Great Wall of China. You wouldn't have the, I don't know, bloody St. Paul's Cathedral, whatever. Those things have always, that's always happened a bit.
I guess one of the things I've learned since I became a councillor is that you hear when things are going wrong, but you don't hear about things when going, like if there were no potholes and there was buses running on time, you wouldn't get people on social media going, I love how the buses run on time. I love how smooth our roads are. People wouldn't do that. People are asking us to fix problems.
Yeah.
So, and we're going, well, yeah, that should be the first port of call for a council and councillors, is to get the basics right. However, I can understand that temptation for politicians to want the legacy.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think it's probably good to not get too sidetracked by that. But then this is a city of innovation. This is a city of culture. I mean, we haven't talked about culture.
No.
You say Bristol to people outside of Bristol and they come up with things, don't they? They come up with, they'll probably think of the Clifton Suspension Bridge or Cabot Tower or whatever, but they think about people. They think about artists. They think about so cringy. I was going to say a vibe. There is a kind of
There's a sort of Banksy thing, and there's a kind of radical city. There's a perception,
and that's
of,
not going to change whoever's in power. You know, we want to celebrate that and support that culture.
I think that Bristol, though, and we've spoken about this before, very much is disconnected from other parts of Bristol. Though I think that is a kind of inner ring bit, probably where you guys are pretty strong, but those outer edges in the north and south of the city, it's probably slightly different.
Especially the south. Yeah. And I think that's another reason why it's really good that we're putting Tony Dyer forward, because that is a passion of his, is to focus on South Bristol. And that's what we should be doing. That's what we should be doing.
Because you've got I would imagine, I'll ask you about strategy in a minute, about what are you looking to, because there was that danger. You don't want to lose your base. You want to maintain and build the base you have, but you also want to grow that into new places. So there are green councillors in the south, like Tony and Christine. And is that an area you are looking to expand on?
Yeah, we've got fantastic candidates in Bedminster, Thirlwood, Knowle. So absolutely.
In February, you were criticised for opposing the administration's budget and mm-hmm. not tabling an alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Do you think there was any validity in that analysis? And also now potentially being involved overseeing the administration's budget beyond May, the tables are turning a bit, aren't they? People might be opposing what you're doing then, you know.
Yeah, I think we've got to be really clear about this. There is no us tabling an alternative budget. The process does not allow that, and it has not allowed for collaboration. We have called for the last 2 years running for more input and more collaboration.
Yeah.
What we are left with is this system of putting in amendments. I don't think people are really quite aware of what the kind of constraints around that. You get a very small amount of time with one officer who's very helpful, but you get a few meetings with an officer and look at the budget and the actual budget amendments. They can't be too big. I can't remember the actual figure, but I don't think it's more than a couple of hundred thousand. You know, they're not big, significant chunks of the budget.
Yeah.
They are messing around the edges a little bit. Now, the budget amendments can find some useful things, pet projects in people's wards. It can get a bit pork barrel politics, to be honest. Not only that, while we've had the mayoral model, there's still an executive who has to then implement those amendments. We've brought amendments in the past, which have passed with cross-party support, that haven't been implemented. What came up a lot at the budget meeting was this notion of it being a pantomime. And that was said quite
bluntly. By
Mark Weston. You were talking about the Tory leader. He rubs his hands with glee. They're playing budget bingo.
And who were playing budget bingo? The administration?
No, the Conservatives. To them, it is a pantomime. And we realised it was a pantomime. We looked at the budget. We looked at amendments. I think I used the term at the time, rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. This is a budget that is going to affect people's lives. It's a cuts budget. There is serious worries around adult social care. There's serious worries about education. You're looking at things that really affect people's lives. And we did not want to be involved in the pantomime because it is a pantomime. And the fact that the other parties spent their speeches, you know, deriding us for not playing the game rather than actually talking about people in Bristol.
Oh, they all teamed up on you a bit, did they?
And, you know, rather than actually talking about the people that this budget was going to affect, I found it really distasteful, actually. You might be able to hear, I'm quite annoyed. And so, you know, you say we're not whipped. It was pretty unanimous that we were not going to play that game this time around. It's like, this is a farce. This is a farce because there is this, I think Marvin said, you've had this amount of time to look at it. It's not true. There's a basic scrutiny function that looks at certain parts of the budget. It's not collaborative. I was speaking to a council leader in London, a Labour leader, and she was like, didn't the mayor get you into his office as leader of the opposition to sit down and discuss how you were going to approach the budget? And I sort of laughed and was like, I think I've had a conversation in Marvin's office once in my life, you know.
That's, is that all?
Yeah. It's like we didn't have that collaboration. So... Yeah.
Did you think with certain personalities out of the way, that's going to change then, hopefully?
Well, certain personalities, but also the system's going to change.
We're going to be in a
committee model. We're going to have to work together. I've said this a lot of times, this interview, but we are. And how we approach the budget, I think, is going to be a real test of that.
Yeah. Right. Livable neighbourhoods.
Yes.
I think you're going to bring more in, or you hope to bring more in. Right?
I really hope so.
There's been a lot of opposition for those. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people, particularly in Barton Hills. Yeah. Kind of people feel a bit put on by it, or what? Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I think livable neighbourhoods as a concept is a really great idea. This is another thing where behind the scenes I've been doing lots of research, both as group leader, but also in my role as Shadow Cabinet Member for Transport and Active Travel. How they are implemented and how they are done in other places. Again, we've seen what works, what doesn't work. This is a really good example of where if we had been under a committee system and we had parties working together, that probably would have been a lot more successful.
Why?
But what we had was this extremely long consultation period that I don't think really consulted in the right way, because a lot of communities in that area felt very disenfranchised and disempowered.
I think from the conversations I had, particularly in Barton Hill and St. George, it was who was conducting consultation, where that was taking place, and certain communities, particularly Smiley community, felt like completely disconnected and not spoken to about any of this. And really felt that things are happening to their community, rather than them being involved. Yeah.
They had been promised more input and they hadn't got that. And we have a very active board councillor there, Yasser Mohammed, who is Somali, who has the trust of the Somali community. Under a committee system, under a collaborative approach, they could have used Yasser to do that consultation and get that community on board with this.
Okay.
What happened?
It's primarily council officers, wasn't it?
What then happened is Yasser represented that community to help them get their voice heard. And then what we got from Labour was Greens are opposing a liberal neighbourhood.
I see.
And it became very toxic again. We need to learn from that. You know,
what was Hikmat Jarma doing?
I don't know. I don't know where she was. I think, yeah. Okay. She certainly wasn't as involved as Yasser was.
That's a Labour, the other Labour councillor.
The other Labour councillor. So I think we need to learn from that.
Yeah.
Again, other places are...
So you think the process itself, if the process is improved, how you do it, you could get people on board more. I get that to an extent, but the very notion of, particularly inner city communities that have got slightly competing demographics a little bit on some of this stuff. There's a lot of taxi drivers, lots of people with big families and cars taking kids to school,
disabled
community. So that's very different than other people that are cycling everywhere and stuff. The charge is that this tends to take place and go through often deprivation areas and often areas with multicultural communities. Well, certainly the ones that are being proposed. Yeah, is that going to change?
I think with livable neighbourhoods, there's two factors to remember. One is,
do you want to just quickly explain what a livable neighbourhood is?
Livable neighbourhood, really, in a nutshell.
It's basically
a way to, again, prioritise things like walking and wheeling safely around a community, but it also prevents cars from cutting through. I think since sat-navs and Google Maps in, you get sent through all the cut-throughs, and that often goes through the heart of a residential community.
So it sort of takes away the rat runs.
It takes away traffic in residential streets. It makes streets a lot safer. So it's about reclaiming streets for kids to play in and for people to walk around safely and reducing air pollution. Mm-hmm. It's been implemented very successfully in other cities. You've got to be able to take a community with you, though. So as you say, so people don't feel like something's being done to them, but it's being done for them and with their consent. The other difficulty with them is it's a bit of a suck it and see approach. You know, when people have low traffic neighbourhoods, livable neighbourhoods, they tend to like them once they're there. So there's been places in London like Lambeth where... In Lambeth, I met the Labour leader there and she was fantastic. But what she was saying was it was under lockdown. We went and put these temporary measures in and just said, ta-da, when people sort of came out of lockdown. And people liked them. They still had feedback, but the feedback was very practical stuff like, oh, you've put a planter near a drop curb. Can you move it? Things like that. So people have to experience them to see the benefit of them. The other thing they did in Lambeth was the businesses that were very upset about them was going, oh, our businesses are going to go down. We had that in Bristol, in even Princess Victoria Street in Clifton, when that was pedestrianised, businesses got very upset. So what they did is they got council officers to work with businesses to look at their business plans and to see how much of it was actually the livable neighbourhood, how much of it was other factors, but if there was anything else that could then support that business. So I think a lot of...
There's an irony to this, isn't there? Maybe different in Bedminster, and I, this is slightly generalising, but there's an irony to some of this, though, that I do think, and I am stereotyping, Emma, but I do think the people who are pro-livable neighbourhoods that I've spoken to do tend to be from a certain demographic, yeah?
And people who are 100%.
Yeah, yeah. And the people who oppose it, and I saw this on St. Mark's Road when that old stuff was kicking off there, where the irony to me is that kind of lots of those streets... were regenerated by migrant communities and lots of businesses in Barton Hill, particularly St. Mark's Road, where there was talk of this happening, I think in other cities where these sort of proposals have been put in place, that's changed the area. Then people move into that area from outside. In Bristol, there is a predominantly white, predominantly middle class, not all from London, but quite a lot, come in and then want to change that community that drew them there in the first place. And I think people feel, particularly if you're a minority community where you're sensitive to that sense of disempowerment anyway for rightful reasons, feel like people coming in with sharp elbows and suddenly coming in and trying to change what things are and affecting our livelihoods. There's a lot more to it than just environmental stuff. And I think that perhaps some green activists and green councillors need to have that more front and centre of their mind.
I think we do have that front centre of our mind. And that's why our main criticism of how the East Bristol Liverpool neighbourhood was done is that they didn't start with those communities and they didn't do that, the kind of groundwork with those communities, and therefore they ended up with the pushback instead of using them as a starting point. So and then when our Green councillor did support that community, we got accused of being the naysayers and blocking things, and that could have been done so differently, because those inner city areas do have higher levels of pollution. They are the children who are suffering more with asthma. Children living in high rises in inner city areas are have, I think it's like 10-15 year less life expectancy.
And that's the argument that gets lost in there. I agree with you.
Absolutely.
That's the argument that gets lost. It directly affects people from those communities
more.
But I don't think that message that message is coming across.
No, you know,
clear
I'm in Bishopston and I get 5 emails a week asking me, when can we have a livable neighbourhood? I want a livable neighbourhood. Now, what we could have done is say all the, as you say, the more empowered middle class areas who know what a livable neighbourhood is and want it for themselves, we could have gone there and it would be popular and spread it from there. But actually, I do understand why the administration went for that area first, because that is where the data shows us that people have a lower life expectancy from levels of air pollution. Yeah. And there is the most need for them, but you have to take people with you, and you have.
Where are the new ones going to be?
The next one is South Bristol, so that's the next one on the list. After
whereabouts?
That, I think it's sort of a Windmilly Hill, Bedminster area. It's quite a big one. That's the other thing about livable neighbourhoods, is you have to do a reasonable chunk at a time. The one in East Bristol is very large, and other cities have put them in a lot cheaper and more, but smaller. So it was very ambitious. And I think the one in South Bristol is going to be quite big as well. Beyond that, I don't know. I mean, as I say, our area would love one.
But it's become quite a toxic debate, hasn't it? Nationally, was it the sort of whole 10, is it 10 minute cities or 20 minute cities? I can't 50. Quite remember.
Well, it depends. Yeah, I think there's a few different
15,
versions.
Is it?
15 minutes.
Yeah,
it's 15minutes, I think.
Within the whole sort of like culture wars sort of right wing playbook a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
It was so...
Did you go to any of the meetings? It all got a bit nuts, didn't it? So I was told.
It got nuts. It was weird, because I think what happened was the American right-wing press, like Fox News, they picked up on the concept and then decided that it had something to do with like restricting civil liberties, because obviously in America, they're very more car-centric. So the idea that you wouldn't allow people to drive places
in
America.
Gun removed, isn't it?
Yeah, right. And I've got a friend who's a Green councillor in Oxford, and she was getting death threats. And she's like, this is madness. And so I think it did get picked up by some conspiracy theorists, where really the idea of being able to just walk to amenities in 15 minutes. I mean, in Britain, that should be a bit of a given anyway. In America, I can imagine them thinking that was awful, because they drive everywhere, because it's a lot more spread out. But in a city the size of Bristol in the UK, that shouldn't be controversial. We surely should want to be able to get to everything we need within a 15-minute walk or public transport of our homes.
It jumped on, hasn't it? Civil liberties argument. There is also a danger that, I suppose, if somebody opposes this, then they are some kind of right-wing populist nutter. And I think there was some criticism for an article in The Cable, actually. I can't remember who wrote it, that it was potentially a little bit casting aspersions at anybody that opposed the liberal neighbourhood. You've got to be careful with that as well.
There's a lot of misunderstandings. And I think you often get the sort of, I don't know, maybe I'm stereotyping and being awful, maybe sort of older, slightly more right-wingy, traditionally people who are very wedded, you know, the war on motorists, we've mentioned it already, people who would be like, this is a war on motorists and I want to be able to drive up to my front door and drive wherever I want. They're often the same people who are on Facebook sharing memes about, remember when we could play in the streets? Really, that's all we're trying to do is go back to a place where kids can play, kick a ball up a wall in the street without getting hit by a car. Really, that kind of nostalgia we have for kids playing in the streets is, we have organisations in Bristol, Safer Streets organisations, that's all they're trying to do is
It all comes back to messaging, I think. It all comes back to how the message is delivered and who is delivering the message.
Yeah.
But like you said about Tony coming in and doing his thing, and kind of in South Bristol, people will listen to him because of who he is, and that actually the right people put forward to present this stuff. And I think one of the problems at the moment with social media is that everything gets polarized, doesn't it? And becomes elevated, and we lose that complexity, but also somebody to break it down in real terms. I'll give an opinion now. I'm not supposed to give an opinion. I think the Green movement could be better at this. And I think that perhaps there's lessons that are being learned, and that's shifting and changing a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. And I think going way back to the beginning of this conversation about how how the green movement is growing and where we are getting new members and candidates from, we're becoming more diverse and there is more diversity of opinion. And I hope that will strengthen us because we will get different points of view. Those meetings we have behind closed doors where we're coming up with our steers rather than whipping will be enriched by lots of different opinions. When you say we're getting people from other parties, then you're getting different points of view there as well. You're getting different takes on things. You know, we are attracting a more diverse range of people. However, we are still the Green Party. We're still the Marxists on bikes. Isn't that what we're often called?
Tories on bikes or Marxists on bikes, depending on who you talk to. Yeah. Big challenges ahead for you.
Yes.
You're confident that you're going to expand. How many, give a number on it. How many are you going to get more?
30. There we go. I've literally just picked that out of thin air, but
30 more or 30?
No, 30 total.
Oh, so you're going to gain seven. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel that's confident and ambitious, but not overconfident. I don't know. Yeah. I think we're going to do well.
Yeah. And you're pretty, in your seat's pretty safe, isn't it?
I hope so.
Bishop's there, then Ashley Dane. I don't know though, actually, because you might have a load of Rovers fans voting against you. After what happened with the stadium?
Maybe. I don't know. The doorsteps seem pretty good. So
can we talk about that just briefly before we go? As a Bristol Rovers season ticket holder, as a Bristol Rovers season ticket holder, I've heard different stories of this depending on who I talk to.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, those listening, this was all to do with the safe stand at Bristol
Rovers.
They didn't have planning permission.
Yeah.
And then they started building it without planning permission. They built it without planning permission. Yeah. The residents were kicking off a bit. You were reflecting that. They did pause the work and then they suddenly continued it again without planning permission.
Yeah.
It was all a bit bloody weird.
It was.
All of it.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, yeah, in a nutshell, we've got a very long planning backlog. They were informed by somebody in the council that they should just go ahead and build it.
He's a Rovers fan, isn't he, I think so.
I think it might be. So they went ahead
and built San Diego. I think it's in America, no?
They went ahead and built without planning permission. Obviously, the whole reason we get planning permission is so that residents have input into that. Obviously, residents were very upset because they didn't know what was being built, how big it was going to be. They were being disturbed by noise. So as ward councillor, I supported them when it looked like it wasn't going to be torn down or anything. So when we realised it was going to go through the planning process, regardless, I said, right, well, let's try and at least build that relationship between the club and residents.
Yeah.
So I had many meetings with the club. I have had many meetings with residents. And to this day, I'm still managing that relationship and trying to get the club to do the best things for the residents.
And inside the club, Rovers in their wisdom basically was selling season tickets. This was the pressure really, wasn't it? Because Rovers were selling season tickets to people, 5,000, I think, in that safe stand.
Yeah.
Before they even started building it. Not before they even started building it, before they even had planning permission.
Yeah.
And I think a conversation allegedly took place between two people and it's like, well, just go ahead and do it.
Allegedly,
No one's gonna knock on the end anyway, because there'd be uproar amongst sort of Rovers fans. So very rarely did these things get turned down. So crack on with it. But what did happen actually, it made the club a laughing stock to Bristol City, which we don't need to give them any more ammunition than they've already got, but laughing at us anyway. And it just delayed all these people that had paid to the season tickets, and they were relocated in other parts of the ground. So the Rovers fans were quite angry at the club and angry at what was going on, right?
Mm. Okay.
And my question to you is, and I guess you do have to be a little bit careful what you say, but I'll ask you anyway, is the narrative was being spun or being manipulated, however you want to, or being presented, however you want to see it. It was all the Green Party's fault.
Yes, it was.
By the Labour administration. Yeah. They were quite involved in this a bit more. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would think that's pretty fair. And I think that was quite a low point, I think.
And that was playing to the gallery, because football fans can be quite hardcore. And you were getting a bit of shit for that, weren't you?
I was getting a lot of shit for that. And I think also it was an easy deflection of responsibility. I certainly wouldn't say there's no crossover between Greens and football fans. We have a lot of football fans in our ranks. But we're probably not traditionally seen as a party where, you know,
there's context to this, because in the past, when there's been applications, well, for Bristol City as well as Bristol Rovers, there have been green campaigners.
Yeah.
I'm doing quote air signs, that had sort of opposed those things. So already it was seen as, oh, these bloody green activists stopping our stand. That was played to the gallery a little bit, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And also, you know, I think me being a woman as well, that makes put a bit more of a target on my back. Again, it's an easy thing as a Green Party woman. I don't look like I'm the classic kind of somebody who'd stand up for football. Yeah. Actually, from a family that absolutely loved football, but anyway. But
you were being a NIMBY, getting in the way.
Being a NIMBY, but the term NIMBY stands for not in my backyard. This was lit. They were literally building an Italian football stand in one of my residents' backyards, and it's like I'm elected to represent in my whole ward. But
although some people, if somebody moves, it's like when somebody moves next door to a nightclub, they complains about the noise. There were a few people interviewed on Points West. I'm like. And they're like, they've been there 18 months and you move next door to a bloody football stadium. What do you expect?
Yeah, and I think that's probably true for some, but speaking to the residents, a lot of them have said, we're not against the football. We've lived next to the football stadium for ages. We just don't know what they're building. They're starting work at 6 o'clock in the morning. They've cut a lot of trees down. There was other aspects within that, that the actual building practices, they weren't being very well regulated. And without that planning permission, that was really hard to manage. But I also wanted to build that relationship between the club and the residents because the club's in my ward too. And I wanted to help the club and I still do. And I've offered them support, like with their transport plan, with their traffic plan, hooking them up with
relations. Did the club...
They're improving.
Did they side with the Labour administration a little bit at that time?
At first, I think the club were very suspicious of me. They were very suspicious. I think they'd been told I was not to be trusted. And it took a while. It certainly does help that my new co-councillor is a Rovers fan. So we tend to, you know, because there was a by-election last summer. And so we can slightly good cop, bad cop it a little bit.
Politics, man. It's dirty, isn't it? It's dirty. Say journalists are dirty. Bloody hell.
Yeah,
if there's any consolation across all this stuff, though, whether, and I think you were obviously kicking back as the party on social media and it played out as a bit of a ding-dong between you and Labour. Is any consolation about this, despite political differences, despite, you know, whatever relationship is now with the club, since that South Stand has gone up, Rovers are still crap.
I've heard
In fact, we've got worse.
How many games is it now since we scored?
Well, we scored the other week. We scored on Saturday. We beat Cheltenham.
That's all that noise
was. Before that, it was seven that was away. So it was a no, but seven games Rovers didn't score.
There you go.
And we're probably a lot worse than we were when the South Stand wasn't put up and we weren't that great then. So
there we go.
So there's no chance you will lose that then, Bishopston and Ashley Dane?
I think we're comfortable. I think we're fine.
This is your chance to appeal to any Rovers fans listening, though.
I obviously up the gas always. No, I genuinely, we've been getting on really well and I've been really I've been encouraging them to have community meetings, which they've had with our residents. And we always go up there. We've got a much better dialogue with them. And that trust goes both ways. You know, if they were told that we were against them, then we're having to earn their trust and they've had to earn the trust of the residents. And so that's an ongoing relationship that we really want to see.
Let's wrap it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you are far more than Tories on bikes, far more than Marxist on bikes. And this one as well, which I've not seen this one, Lib Dems with sandals. I like that.
Lib Dems in sandals.
Lib Dems with sandals.
And with lentil munchers as well. That was a Richard Eddie. We're talking about Richard. So he'd have to eat the lentils if he'd done them. And I don't think he's got it in him, to be honest.
No. he strikes me as the type of bloke that would wear sandals anyway, with socks, I reckon.
Maybe on his holidays, you reckon?
Yeah. Not that. I mean, mind you, Stormzy's made that all again, hasn't he, in Sliders. Thank you, Emma. That's been great. Thanks. Is there anything you want to do, a little kind of end spiel to say why should people vote the Green Party in this new era of, and your own words, openness and transparency?
Openness, transparency, getting involved, back to basics, and just we're shaking things up a bit, aren't we? So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great.
Excited, yeah?
Yeah, I am. Great candidates doing fabulous things, and I'm really looking forward to working with them all.
Brilliant. And hopefully I didn't ask too many questions. It was exactly the same as last time.
It's always more stuff to talk about, isn't there?
I'm fairly one-dimensional with my interviews, really. So if I interview a third time, it will probably be exactly the same again.
The answers might change. You never know.
They might. You might become all power mad and all sort of controlling and wanting to build like the biggest skyscraper in the Southwest by the time we talk to each other next time.
Out of bamboo.
Straw on top. Right. Thank you.
Lovely. Cheers, Bill. Bye.
Bye-bye. Many thanks to Emma Edwards, the councillor for Bishopston and Ashley, and the group leader for the Green Party in Bristol, for joining us for this election special of Bristol Unpacked. I'm Neil Maggs. Big thanks to our production team from the Bristol Cable. Also, Blue Dot for our music.